Good morning. A report on the economic impact of Hawaii's seed industry is out this week. Economist Paul Brubaker compiled it, and he joins us to look beyond the highlights of the now 50-year-old industry. Meanwhile, Vani Hari, also known as the Food Babe, is in town to ask her UH audience to focus on the ethics of eating. She wants a food revolution that starts with consumers knowing what's in their food. We'll talk with her later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Bill Sage. Mashkanada. What does that really mean? Well, we'll ask the man who popularized the song, Sergio Mendez. And sister Joan of Arc Souza explains the real reason why it's important to bring the Ninth Island to Manoa.
It's Wednesday, September 14th, and that's The Conversation. First, this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Bill Sage.
Good morning, Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, as a graduate of Pun-aho,
I could make
some remark like how my greeting is going to seed, but far be it from me from being far from being capable of doing such a thing.
Oh, we know quite the opposite, don't we? But that does bring us to our first conversation. Now, the tension between the seed industry and the anti-GMO community may be a little more fraught this week. The Hawaii Crop Improvement Association, which represents Hawaii's seed industry, released its economic report analyzing the now 50-year-old seed industry. According to the report, the total economic impact of that industry in Hawaii is $323 million, with its research having global reach. Economist Paul Brubaker compiled the report. He joins us now. Good morning. Thanks for coming in. This really makes the case that this is the dominant ag industry in Hawaii, doesn't it?
So, newsflash, it has been for the last 10 years.
But a lot of people don't really think about it in that sort of way. I mean, there's a lot of thinking about what Hawaii used to produce and how it used to produce it, but not really looking at it in these terms. But you make it really concrete what it's worth and how its value has changed over the last half century.
Well, sure. It's you know, the seed industry has been on Molokai for longer than pineapple was on Molokai. So if people are stuck in the past, I can't really help that. You know, we used to ride horses, but who cares? The most important thing about the recent findings, which, by the way, have nothing to do with anti-GMO denialism, you see if you read the report, but is really the shift that's happened just in the last few years, because the industry used to be making a contribution around $500 million, and that's actually subsided to the $300 million or so that that I estimated in the current study.
With the fact that this is worth so much, and we also have so little land, there seems to be, though, a natural tension there of what do we do as we go forward now that we have additional lands on Maui and there seems to be a lot more interest in doing diversified ag. When you came to the end of the report, you mentioned that the way the value added of the research and development of this model could be, in fact, a model for the future. Does that sort of set the communities who want to have more produced in Hawaii for Hawaii at odds with a community that says we have to be doing research that has global impact?
Yeah, so there's two conversations going on here. You know, one is about what's happened with the seed industry, and then there's another one to which you allude, in which people seem to be concerned that 5,000 acres that the seed industry actively cultivated in the last couple years is somehow going to displace the 2 million acres of agricultural land in Hawaii that are available today. We can talk about this report, but I don't even understand what people are thinking when they express the kind of concern to which you alluded. I'm not saying it's you, but
We hear this, you know, from people.
I know,
we've had many conversations about this.
Well, I don't know what to say. So you're wrong, It has. What are you even talking about? Let me repeat what I just said. 5,000 acres actively cultivated out of perhaps 10, which most of which is fee simple owned. They bought their land and it's ag land. So there's the seed industry. Then there's the 2 million other acres, or I guess technically 1,990,000 acres of ag land in Hawaii that's left over. I mean, nothing's preventing anybody from going out and growing other crops. And in fact, 3/4 of agriculture in Hawaii is other crops, or crops and livestock. And I like to include aquaculture now, since that's gotten to be significant, and document that in the report as well. But I do not understand that conversation. I don't even know why there is such a conversation.
A lot of it's very emotionally driven. You know, you've heard a lot of that.
Inaccurate and emotional.
And that seems to be countered by what you produced in this report.
I'm not countering anything. The report doesn't counter any of that. The report doesn't actually bring any of that up. It's not about the rest of agriculture. I love the rest of agriculture and what opportunities lie there. This report is just about the seed industry.
Right, but I mean, in saying that, look, here is the seed industry for what it is and for what it produces, that seems to have a de facto counter to all the other arguments that have been coming up that, as you say, you don't understand and that seem to be, you know, not based in reality.
It's not my intent. So, to your point, Alexander Baldwin has 30,000 acres of prime agricultural land currently under cultivation in sugar that's going to be available next year, not to mention all of West Maui, not to mention all of the tens of thousands of acres that have become available as plantation agriculture has diminished in economic importance over the last, 30 years, 40 years? So, and in that time, the seed industry has grown, as have many other agricultural activities, but the seed industry over a 50-year period has grown to fill a tiny part of that vacuum. As I say, about 10,000 acres available for cultivation, about 5,000 today that actually are in cultivation. And really, one of the objectives of this study, which updates some earlier versions, is to highlight the fact that research and development, that we think of agriculture, a lot of people think of agriculture as food, but of course there's fiber, there's nursery and floral products, there's bioenergy that seems to be a possibility, and in this case, research and development oriented agricultural activity, really agronomy, that is at the core of the industry. Right at the core of the industry is developing the maize genome, which is the operating system for corn, as we can do in Hawaii because it's in the tropics. We can do that all year round. And because it's in the United States, we have the intellectual property protections that assure scientists that their developments will, that they can secure the rights to them. And because against the backdrop of this transition out of plantation agriculture, there was land and a workforce available to support the growth of this industry.
This industry potentially is going to grow even bigger. Today we heard that Bayer has a successful bid to take over Monsanto. Dow and DuPont are trying to merge. Syngenta has been trying to sell itself. All of these things where we see, you know, greater consolidation in the industry. What do you make of that in terms of Hawaii and what may happen here?
Yeah, actually, I think it's important to understand the context for these changes. As economists might say, in the market for corporate control, the context is actually a decline in the size of the industry as a result of the global drop in commodity prices over the last several years. So for the same reason that in the Dakotas or the Texas Panhandle or in Saudi Arabia and Russia and Venezuela, oil-producing economies are struggling with the fact that oil prices have fallen, the seed industry, which, of course, it produces an input like fertilizer and land and labor and water, that's an input to agriculture, to corn, production elsewhere in the world, that the demand for that input has been declined as the price of corn has fallen from $7 a bushel to half that, $3.50 a bushel. So the corporate merger and acquisition phenomenon you're talking about is really a response to shrinkage of the industry and the corporate players in biopharmaceuticals and chemicals and whatnot that are interested in undertaking this type of activity, rethinking where their own investments are and thinking about merging and
doesn't this also make it sort of ripe for another run-up too?
Yeah, you know, I think I would liken it to, because we've gone from a peak of 240 million to the current level of 150 million. You know, I liken it to an adjustment period. We sort of found the bottom of the current, in the current economic environment, and it turns out we're in the middle of an unwinding of a long cycle in commodity prices that suggest not just corn but agriculture in general and minerals and metals are positioning for, you know, the next wave going out into the mid-2020s, 2020s and 2030s.
As always, I wish we had more time to talk.
Always, right?
Always.
Gone in 5 seconds.
Thank you, Paul, for coming in.
Thank you, Beth Ann, and take care.
Paul Brubaker is the principal of TZ Economics. He's also the director of the Hawaii Economic Association. He compiled the HCIA report on the value of the seed industry in Hawaii. It's out this week. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Now, it's 8, well, in about 6 seconds, it'll be 8:17, so we'll call it 8:17. And coming up, we're going to speak to the man who put Brazil's new wave on the map. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's instantaneous realm of communication via text and social media, it seems that fewer and fewer folks are utilizing snail mail to keep in touch with friends and family. No longer do people go through draft after draft of a letter, licking the envelope and digging up the stamp for the postage. Even with last April's mandated 2-cent reduction in the cost to send a standard-size rectangular envelope, the price tag of shelling out 47 cents for a stamp has many opting out from sending correspondence in the post. Well, things have come so far from 1851, when Hawaii's first stamps were issued. Back then, local and inter-island mail was carried free of charge until 1859. Then the first stamps were printed to pay the international rates then in effect. So for today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name stamp collectors use to refer to the group of stamps that went on sale October 1st in Honolulu and Lahaina back in 1859. Think you know? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Be the first one with the right answer, and you'll get the T-shirt.
I'm Hank Rogers from Blue Startups. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The first time I heard Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66, it was 1966. Every stereo in every dorm room in the cold, rainy environs of my college in Portland, Oregon, was warmed by that very tropical Brazilian groove. Mashkenada, we didn't know what it meant, but oh, did we sing it and dance to it. Now, half a century later, Sergio Mendes is a living legend and treasure, not just for Brazil, but for the entire world. Over 35 albums, many gold and platinum, 3 Grammy Awards, an Oscar nomination for music in the movie Rio. He performed at the Blaisdell last night and plays at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center tomorrow night. And he joined us this morning by phone. Aloha, Sergio.
Good, how are you?
So far, I'm just still sort of I'll try not to be awestruck, but to be talking to you. After
thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Hearing the music after all the time. When I'd like to hearken back to the song that just captured everybody, and, I mean, it was the first Portuguese top 10 hit in the United States, and to this day it's sort of intriguing. What exactly does Mashkinata mean? Is there a translation that would work in English?
Well, I think the best translation would be never mind.
Never mind.
Just never mind, yes.
Just sort of, you just, it's okay, just never mind, just go with it, sort of a feeling?
Yes.
And so the opening, the O Aria, that was...
That's kind of a sound thing, you know, it's just like a chant.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's interesting because, you know, I just came from Japan and the Japanese love that song too. So it's a universal chant.
Once it gets going, it just sort of invokes, it's a good spirit. The song is about just dancing the samba in ways that are cool and just sort of essentially go with it, friends.
Right, exactly.
So when you started out, you were trained as what, a pianist?
Yes.
And then from there, it just evolved into the basic groove. The bossa nova means what, new beat?
New wave, I think, mm-hmm. would be a better description. This was like early 60s, you know.
So it was the new wave then.
Yes.
And once it got started, it just seemed to catch fire. What do you remember as being a really defining moment for you?
I think the playing for the first time at Carnegie Hall in 1962, November of 62, with Jobim and Gilberto and Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, that's when I realized that music, that movement was so strong and so important.
And once you got going, was it Herb Alpert became a good friend, and then you started touring with him?
Absolutely. Herb Alpert at Tijuana Brass and A&M, and I made several records for them. And that was the first big chance that I had to play my music, and because A&M was just starting, and the Tijuana Brass was a huge band, and we toured the world with them, and it was a great thing. It was two very good friends.
So once it got going, and it just kept going, when 1967 happened, and then, is it still Brazil 66? And I do remember I was a DJ in 1977, all of a sudden Brazil 77. So did you guys plan to just keep changing it to 77, 88, 99?
We start playing with the numbers and, you know, the uh-huh. year, and that was about that. And then now it's Brazil 2016. How's that?
Half a century later, still yeah. going strong. And so far, you've worked essentially at virtually every jazz artist and many other classical in the world. When you got into the movie score for Rio, that was just sort of a chance to make a love letter to the world?
That was a wonderful experience working with Carlos Saldanha. He's a young director from Rio de Janeiro. And when he told me about the story and the colors and the sounds, and it was so exciting. So we did Rio 1 and Rio 2. Was a really a great experience for me to be part of that team.
So part of the team, and now you were still touring. I have a feeling that for you, music is not just something you do. It is essential to your way of life and who you are.
Yes, it's my passion. You know, I'm a melody guy. I love mm-hmm. melodies. And so it starts with trying to find a melody and a rhythm to go with it, you know. And in the case of the movie, you know, there's a story that leads you to the melody.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have a task.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie is something like that.
So task-oriented.
Yeah.
And as you go from the task to the completion, it just adds on, here's a melody, and then this, and then this, and then this, and it just keeps growing and growing?
Absolutely, yeah. And then he will show, I mean, Carlos would show me a storyboard, and we'd go from there, you know. This is going to happen now. So, and it's a collaboration work
mm-hmm.
because it was, a lot of people involved on that. There's John Powell, the composer of the movie, and I worked with him. There was Carlinhos Brown, also from Brazil. That was so it's really a wonderful collaboration process to be involved in a movie.
It certainly is. And now here you are, Brazil 2016. What do you envision for the future of your creative process?
Well, you know, right now I just came from, I just woke up to give you this interview.
Dreaming in musical score. Something yes. about the music of Hawaii. It's another País Tropical. And
yes, that's right. That's another great song.
And we have We have such a large Portuguese population here to begin with, so I think Hawaii is a place where the Brazilian groove has been appreciated for over 150 years from the very first immigrants. And now, do you find Hawaii sort of reminding you of home in many ways?
It does. It does, you know. I mean, the vegetation, the plants, the mountains, the ocean, I mean, that's very, it reminds me a lot of Brazil and Rio, and it has that perfume.
The perfume of your music as well. It's an absolute delight speaking with you, and I hope that everything you do in the future will be filled with your wonderful reason for being, the music you create and the sounds you give the world. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Sergio Mendez continues his Hawaii tour tomorrow night at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. We've got all the details on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Que eu quero passar. Hoje o samba está animado. O que eu quero é sambar. Este samba que é misto de maracatu é samba de preto veio.
HBR sustaining members are the heart of the heart of this station. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for the station and that we couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HBR can come to you daily. So please, take the health and well-being of this station seriously and pledge $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong. Call us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose employees and their ohana volunteer with local charities, including the American Heart Association's Heart Walk and the International Coastal Cleanup. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Efforts to improve Hawaii's prison system seem to be on conflicting paths, with one study designing a new OCCC and the main task force that's supposed to revamp prison policy not back until 2018. It seems that they are thwarting each other. With today's reality check, Civil Beat editor and general manager Patty Epler is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So how can we have this situation where we've got, you know, lawmakers wanting the plan for a new prison finished before we go into next session, and that the task force saying, no, 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 wait a minute, we need to have until, you know, 2018.
Well, that's the legislature for you, might be the simple answer. But I think that is one of the questions that the task force was asking yesterday at its first meeting. Aren't we sort of putting the cart before the horse here if we've already hired a consulting firm and contractors to plan, design, price out, find a new location for Oahu Community Correctional Center when we don't even really know what kind of facility we need? And by the way, whatever happened to Justice Reinvestment Program that was supposed to move more folks out of the prison and into the community, sort of community-based programs?
You bring up the whole issue of what's the philosophy behind designing the prison, not just, you know, recapitulating the type of prison that we have in OCCC.
That's right. And I think the task force, which is chaired by, Justice Michael White, is that his name? But at any rate, they are really working hard to try and put together some new prison reform plans and not just full steam ahead, build something no matter what the cost.
Mita Chesney Lind, who we've talked to and you've talked to, longtime advocate for creating a prison system that really works to keep those who need to be in prison, and those who really don't need to be in a prison out of it. She seems to be very much involved with this too, but is that really enough to be able to say that the philosophy behind how we're changing really is going to change?
Well, I think the task force does have quite a few people who are advocates for community programs, such as Maida Chesney-Lynn. I think it's really more going to come down to will the legislature, when it meets in January with this new report from the State Department of Public Safety on OCCC, be able to say, let's just wait one more year. You know, that's the whole reason that they're sending more prisoners off to the Saguaro facility in Arizona, for instance, is to buy themselves some time to do something with OCCC, which is crumbling apart.
Where does this leave the governor then? Because this was such a priority for him coming into this legislative session that was in January.
So the governor really does have a vision for trying to, improve Hawaii's prison system. It's just he can't get the money from the legislature to do it. He had asked for a substantial amount of money, but it just wasn't in the cards for him this year.
Well, we're looking at a price tag, weren't we, of about $650 million?
That's right, $650 million for just one facility. And I think that is why the task force wants to kind of take a step back and say, do we really need something as big as OCCC now? Perhaps it could hold fewer people if we can just, you know, also put some money into community-based programs that are also effective at supervising offenders as they transition back into their normal life.
All right. Well, we're going to hope that all these stars will align and so will the plans as we go forward and pay lots of attention to a long-standing issue. Thanks so much, Patty. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is the editor and general manager of Civil Beat. She's also editor-in-chief of HuffPost Hawaii, and she's joining us all this week with our reality checks. You may have noticed of late a move by fast food restaurants and big food companies to change the formulas of their products to include healthier ingredients. Vani Hari, also known as the Food Babe, feels particularly responsible for some of that. In 2011, she started a blog to investigate what's in ubiquitous items. The latest is an ingredients list of Starbucks drinks. She's the author of The Food Babe Way and refers to her followers as the Food Babe Army. Vani Hari is in Hawaii this week to talk about the ethics of eating, and she's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. So excited to be here in Hawaii. It is my first time here, and it is, wow, amazing.
Well, aloha, and I hope you enjoy your trip. So how is it that you got into becoming the Food Babe from what you say on your blog was a very unhealthy person?
So, you know, I grew up on the standard American diet. I had two immigrant parents from India who came here not knowing a lot about the American food system, but themselves growing up on plant-based foods, grown in their garden, milk from their one cow that they shared in the village. And when they got here to the United States, my dad really wanted to adopt the American culture. And actually, the first thing he did after he had an arranged marriage with my mother, and they came here for their honeymoon, which they ended up living for the rest of their lives in the 60s, was to introduce my mom to a hamburger, because he said, you know, if we're going to be in America, we're going to live like Americans. And growing up in Charlotte, North Carolina, being one of the only Indian children around in my neighborhood and in my school system, you know, I really wanted to fit in as well. And so I kind of shunned the cooking my mom did at home for, like, you know, the traditional Indian cooking that was full of really healthy ingredients, and opted for the fast food. And my parents actually didn't mind feeding that to me because they thought it was cheap and available and everybody else was eating it. And as a result, I had a lot of health issues as a child. I had eczema all over my face, in every crease of my body. Asthma, you know, to the point where I would have to have multiple doctor's visits throughout every single year, either to be on antibiotics or steroids or to take a cortisone shot to control these skin and lung issues, as well as really severe allergies. And my brother also had these issues too. So my parents, like any good parents, thought this was genetic and that the only way to solve this is to really go to the doctor and take these drugs.
But so when did you decide, then to make a shift to change your diet? And did your brother also make that shift?
Well, he was a little bit more reluctant, but I actually had a crisis in my early 20s where I was working a very stressful job, working for a Big Six consulting firm, and I kind of hit rock bottom in my health. I was overweight, very sick. I was in the hospital getting my appendix out and just kind of was fed up with the way that I was feeling and looking and really wanted to change my life. And so I made a commitment to myself and said, you know, I'm going to make health my number one priority. I'm going to figure out how to feel better. And through my discovery and through my research that I used some skills that I learned in high school where I was a nationally ranked debater, where you actually went to libraries and looked through microfiche and journals and things like that. Back then, we didn't have Google. I used those skills to research health and nutrition and started to go to the library and check out giant books on nutrition and start to teach myself what I was eating. And what I found out was actually that the majority of food that I'd been eating had been chemically altered to improve the bottom line of the food industry and not actually put nutrition in my body. And so when I started to make the changes to real, whole, plant-based foods, my body did a 180. Not only did I drop all the weight, but I started to realize a health I never thought was possible. Every single prescription drug I was on several, 6 to 8, depending upon the season, I completely got off of.
So you've had some great, Vonnie, excuse me, but we don't have a whole lot of time. We want to be able to talk to you about a number of things. But so you were able to take control of your own health, and in starting the blog, your intent was to help other people do that too. Some may ask, well, you know, you had particularly good results with your own life, but how do you feel that you've got enough, cred to be able to help people to take on the same issues with their own lives?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, it was over a 10-year journey that led me to this information that I felt comfortable to actually start a blog. You know, before I even started the blog, I was never even actually on social media or anything because you just didn't do that working in the corporate world. And it was the testimony between the people working around me in the office environment that started following some of the principles that I was following and the testimony of friends around me who started eating the way I did and started to pay attention and started to learn from me that really gave me the confidence to start the blog because they said, Vonnie, my life is changing. I feel so much better. You need to share this information with other people. You need to share your recipes, your tips, what you're learning about the food industry so that other people can also learn from that. And at first, you know, when I started the blog, it was me, my mom, and my few friends that were reading. And I never, ever thought what has happened now could ever be possible with millions
of readers
across
the globe.
So I have to ask you,
how exactly do you eat? Are you vegetarian? Do you eat any meat at all?
Actually, I do not label myself. I don't believe in labeling because I love to travel and I love to learn from other cultures. And there are nutritious qualities in all real food. So I am a real foodist if I have to qualify myself.
I get you. So a question for you, though. In talking about something that's pretty serious and certainly was very serious in your life, I got to ask you, why call yourself the Food Babe and talk about the Food Babe Army? Doesn't that sort of undercut the seriousness of all this?
Well, actually, you know, when I started the blog, I didn't think I was going to become an activist. I really wanted a fun name for the blog so that people felt approachable. I also wanted to call the blog EatHealthyLiveForever.com, and my husband, who's a tech geek in the family, thought it was a stupid name and no one would remember it. He actually came up with the name Food Babe, and at first, I was very reluctant to use that name because I never felt like a babe for most of my life. I was very, I just didn't feel pretty or anything like that. And so I said, well, why don't I teach other people how to become a food babe? And that should be the mission. And I actually didn't even put my photo on the header for the first year and a half of the blog because that wasn't the mission, was to showcase me as the food babe. But once I quit my corporate job, I felt like people needed to know who I was, and that's when I started to showcase myself as the food babe. But
Vonnie, we need to go in just a second, but I wanted to ask you just about this in parting, that in trying to help the food industry reshape itself so that it's much more transparent, people know what's in their food, they can make some choices, we've seen some, you know, real shifts. Even, you know, McDonald's changing its McNuggets, and everybody remembers the whole, you know, pink slime issue of a few years ago. What do you think is next that has to happen so that people feel that they have some control in knowing what they're eating?
You know, we have seen a gigantic revolution in the reduction of many additives in our food, everything from artificial food dyes that are linked to hyperactivity in children to other types of dyes like caramel coloring that's linked to cancer, as well as other preservatives that are linked to endocrine disrupting chemicals. And that is going to be fantastic. What we have to do now is start to reduce the chemical load on our food environment, because it's in our water, it's in our food, it's in our bodies. And if we are really going to try to halt the increase in disease, we have to reduce that chemical load. So it's my mission now to really educate people about the chemical loads that they are consuming and being part of, and their choices every single day of what they eat can reduce that chemical load and can reduce their chances of getting some of these diseases and really, you know, improve their outcome in life and feel healthy and feel alive and feel energy. And that's really the goal here with the work that I'm doing, and exposing the fact that industry is working with, you know, quote unquote university or independent professors to really get this information out and really confuse the public about what's happening in the chemical industry.
Vani Hari, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We got to go.
Thanks.
Vani Hari is a food activist, the creator of foodbabe.com, and the author of The Food Babe Way. She's influenced how giants, food giants like Kraft, Subway, Chipotle, Chick-fil-A and Starbucks create their products. She was also named one of the most influential people on the internet by Time Magazine. She'll be the keynote speaker at a panel discussion on the ethics of eating at UH Manoa tomorrow night at 6:30.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. In search of the answer to this quest, I ask people why they're so generous. In the case of Jimmy and Honey Bun Haynes, it was clear they're having fun helping others.
Yeah. But, I mean,
Honey Bun managed fundraising for the Hui No Eau for years and generated much of the money needed to build the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, where Jimmy is the chairman of the board. She founded Maui Calls, a gala built around the essence of Honolulu's boat days, which recaptures the atmosphere of aloha and generosity. Jimmy was a regent for the University of Hawaii, and they've both done a whole lot more. The Haynes story is a fascinating one. Here's a clip of Jimmy and Honey Bun discussing their philosophy of giving.
As our prosperity enabled us to be more and more generous, it appeared to me, and I can't quantitate this at all, that the more we gave, the more we received, and our wealth grew.
It's been so rewarding for us to give.
Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. Good morning, Bert.
Hey, good morning, Bill. How you doing?
So far, so good. I always really loved the phrase, the high seas. Everybody thinks of pirates and arr, matey, but of course, this SEAS is an acronym, which is Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. The Mars Simulation, that's the topic tonight?
That's absolutely right. So they've been going on these extended duration missions over on the in the habitat on Mauna Loa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they first went out there, they did like a 6-month thing, and they were studying different kinds of foods that they could, you know, maybe work on and create and recipes and cook. And then they extended it to a couple of 8-month durations. And this particular one is a 12-month duration mission, and I think they've gone far beyond, you know, the cooking experience and looking at what kinds of challenges the, you know, the mission participants face over a 12-year period. I mean, a 12-month period.
Yeah,
you know?
Matter of fact,
like, well, you know, what are you going to do in a habitat for 12 months with your crewmates?
One of the guys we talked to, Tristan Bassingthwaite, was on, and he said the main thing was privacy. They're working on making privacy a little more private.
Oh, good. We'll talk to him about that.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks so much for talking to us, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's tonight at 5, Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozell. Earlier today, we put on our white gloves and thumbed through Great-Grandpa's stamp album looking for a group of Hawaiian stamps first issued October 1st, 1851 at the Honolulu and Lahaina post offices. They had three values, 2, 5, and 13 cents. They were all printed locally by letterpress at the government printing office. A 4 13-cent stamp was issued early in April 1852 with the words HI and U.S. postage, now printed in place of Hawaiian postage. It's very unlikely you'll dig one of these philatelic gems in Great-Grandpa's stamp collection up, but then again, it might just be your luck to come across a missionary or two. Collectors refer to these Hawaii first stamps as the missionary issue, based on the fact that these typeset rarities are most often found on correspondence from the American missionaries in Hawaii. It's now 8:49. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. When you're in charge of a nonprofit, fundraising is always a very important part of keeping that nonprofit in the best of shape. And when your nonprofit is a school founded by the Sisters of St. Francis 92 years ago in Manoa Valley, the job you have of educating and inspiring your students is one of the best and most rewarding things you can do. St. Francis School did an excellent job preparing one student for life. Not only is she an alumna of St. Francis School, she's also the principal. Sister Joan of Arc Souza, and she's with us by phone this morning. Aloha, Sister Joan.
Good morning, Bill.
Everything going well?
Oh, yes.
I always was thinking back to the, it's a nonprofit, and a school is still a school, and there are lots of expenses. Now, when you start out, I imagine like with anything else, the cost of tuition has gone up over the years, and you have a lot of students who have special needs in terms of just financial, is that right?
Oh, that's correct. Yes, we do.
So what happens in terms of fundraising as an art? And when you think about it, you started out years ago. I don't know if it would be rude for a gentleman to ask a lady what her tuition would be when she was at the school, but I imagine.
It was about $300.
$300, that's a year.
That's for the entire year.
And if you're a senior now?
It's $11,900.
So it's just a little bit more.
Just a bit.
But the school, it was started by the inspiration of St. Mary Ann?
Well, yes, because the young women who entered the community came into the school without a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So the sisters back then in 1924 applied for a license to educate these young women. And then the school just grew into what it is today.
So as a co-ed school, that came about under your direction, or was that a little bit before?
No, I was the one who did that in 2006. We decided we needed to open the elementary, have a full school, and go co-ed.
Okay, so once that's implemented, so now it's, 10 years later. How long, so when the first co-ed graduating class then would have been the...
I believe the first class, because we cut it short. We started adding the boys and upper levels after we made that first initial. Mm-hmm. So 3 years ago was our first co-ed class.
So the school now has been there in Manoa, same campus, for 92 years?
Well, we moved here in 1931.
Oh, 31, okay.
Yes.
So now the school is up and it's running and it's open, and are there plans for expansion in the future?
There's always plans for expansion. We right now have a little over 500. Our goal is to eventually reach 600 students, and then it would be capped at that.
Is that just because of size limitation?
Yes.
What about future building plans?
Well, we're talking about renovating our auditorium, which was built during the war, and it, it needs some attention. So we're going to be working on that.
In terms of the logistics of running a nonprofit school, I imagine the church itself, the Catholic Church, does it provide a lot of the funding? Or how much, if you did a breakdown and cost analysis just to keep this beautiful nonprofit school running year to year, how does the budget break down?
The church does not support St. Francis School. St. Francis is a private school.
Okay.
So we're supported by tuition, donations, fundraising, and the Sisters of St. Francis.
Is this typical of most parochial schools?
If they're private. If they're parochial, then the church does sponsor them.
So, because a lot of, forgive my ignorance, but a lot of people tend to sort of conflate the two. So parochial is a Catholic church sponsored and funded, but a private Catholic institution has to do everything on its own.
That's correct.
So when you are doing everything on its own, you probably have some ideas sitting down with the staff and the sisterhood. You have both members of sisterhood. Do you also have laity on your instructional staff?
Oh, of course.
And
we have more laity than we have sisters.
So if that's the case, you find that you get what you pay for.
Exactly.
And if you want to hire the best teachers, they need to be, the labor is worthy of his hire.
That's correct.
So let's see. In that case, getting fundraising going along with tuition to help out students, and you guys also essentially tithe to schools in Kenya?
Yes, we have a sister school in Kenya, and their tuition is $300.
Okay.
So for every $300 that we can send them, they not only educate a child, that child has breakfast, lunch, books, everything.
So you have to get creative, and suddenly you remembered, hey, lots of nuns like to go to Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
So from there, when did the idea start to bring the Ninth Island to Oahu?
I started talking about it to people, asking them what they would think about it if we did this maybe about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we did it for the first time. It's all fun and games, and people in Hawaii are constantly going to Vegas, so why not bring a little bit of Vegas to Hawaii?
So last year it was successful and raised a good deal of funds to help. It's for scholarship funding, right?
It did. This year we hope to raise even more.
Well, I wish you all the best of the success. The Ninth Island coming to Manoa, it's a lot cooler than the other Ninth Island.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Sister Joan, well, the odds are good that it's going to be another good year, and I thank you so much for being with us this morning. I wish you all the best and success.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome. Aloha.
Aloha.
Sister Joan of Arc Souza is the principal of St. Francis School and their fundraiser, Ninth Island in Manoa, is this Saturday night in the gym auditorium. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation for the Odds. I mean, for more information. I think we had the perfect example of the eclectic nature of a conversation today. Everything from Sergio Mendez getting actually sit there and talk to a guy. Hey, what's the song mean? And the person says, sure. And then finding out about the ethics of eating and then seeds and Ninth Island Manoa. How do we get specific about such wonderful topics all over the place? Almost a Catholic idea in the sense of being universal.
Well, we try to cover a great many subjects, as you know, on the conversation, because we are such a varied and wide group, and yet we're a small place, too. A lot going on here, and a lot more that we'll be talking about when we come back to you tomorrow. And one of the things that is on our agenda is the Neha Energy Storage Conference. It just wrapped up. We're going to be talking about some of the takeaways.
Plus, we'll have a career spanning 40 years and a chance to sit down with American jazz fusion band Spyro Gyra. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And just a quick note, if you call our talk back line, please be sure to leave us your name and your phone number and the town from which you're calling, okay? And that way we can include it on our in our Friday Letters segment. Now, if you missed any part of this show, or if you want to hear a segment again from a past show, you can find all of that on the Conversation page. It has links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation. It's all on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning with more of the Conversation. See you then.